pimps, youth and misuse. And my name is Leo Busted, and I'm more of a sheep doctor and a pig doctor, and but I have a general practitioner with a much better name for a veterinarian, a Dr. Kind, Bob Kind, and we like that because that's what we are relative to animals. At least that's what we teach them in our veterinary college, and I'm sure at Kansas too. He's a graduate of Kansas, and I from Washington State. And I asked Bob if he wouldn't sit in here and answer all the tough questions, and also give some of his experiences from his practice as we proceed through here. And he kindly agreed to do this, and then I got laryngitis. But he's still going to help. And the subjects, the main emphasis then are on pets and on dogs and cats. And if we get time, I'm going to give the summary from these slides. You've seen the introduction. I have good news and bad news for you. And I'm going to give you the bad news first. And the bad news is the real mad indulgence in pets. There's an absurd exaltation, really, of certain animals. It's reminiscent of one pharaoh in ancient times who had 12,000 servants who took care of his sacred dogs and cats. And we are approaching this kind of a thing, and I'll give you the nature of the situation. Right now, the U.S. pets get more nutritious meals and probably overall better medical attention than most of the people in the world. They are surrogate children, husband, wife. And relative to medical attention, I know some of them will spend money probably for their dog and cat where they might forego it on some of the family, especially the mother-in-law. In this regard, I recall a recent cartoon. This fellow was laying in bed, and his wife was ministering to him, and she says, "I know now why we didn't get you that flu shot. We only had enough money for one shot, and we got the dog his distemper shot." And that's sort of the priorities that are set in many areas today. And the extent of this is there is close to 100 million dogs and cats in the United States. We don't have a real good handle on it. There are 8,000 horses, and I can certainly tell that. I know in our clinic at Washington State University. In fact, we had them on the platform when I left. And the majority of the large animals are horses. And some dogs are very bright and some aren't so bright. And you are now listening to one whose IQ is below detection. I'm trying to say that, Judy. In fact, I want to tell you a story about that. That's a St. Bernard out here. And I helped raise her, so I guess I have to take part of the blame. Every time I'd come up here, I'd talk to her, she has a real complex, as some dogs do get. We first got a golf cart in here, and Bernie, that's not her. What's the full name of Bernie? No, it's something else. It's a very long name, but well, it's incidental. She goes by Bernie. If you called her full name, she wouldn't know who you were talking to anyway. But Bernie fell in love with the golf cart. And she'd ride around in it. And she was really in love with this golf cart. And then one day, when Al was backing it around, he ran into her. And the romance was over. And he went in for lunch. And when he came back out, Bernie had eaten up the seat. There was rubber all over. And ever since, Bernie has been barking at the golf cart. So if you want Bernie to bark, get the golf cart. Right, back to the unprepared text. And there are, I told you, there's almost 100 million dogs and cats. There are 350 million pet fish. My daughter has two of them. And, there are 22 million pet birds and a lot of exotic species. And there comes one of my hang-ups, because I'm opposed to these. And I want to get Dr. Kine's view on this too, and I'll have more to say about this later. But exotic pets have broken up more homes than almost anything else. And they have mistreated them, and they have not taken care of them. And right now, I think in Florida, there are probably over 40 feral species. And some of them are destroying the environment in many places. And I know, or they get some of these exotic pets get loose. One fellow had a pet kangaroo. And it got loose in Illinois, and it hopped for 250 miles, and in the process clobbered a number of cops. So they zapped a number of cops. So you have this kind of a problem, and some of it's worse. In New York City alone, there have been 38,000 dog bites that resulted in having medical attention. And you can imagine, I won't give you the tons of fecal material and the gallons of urine, but it's very substantial. There are $5 million lost per year to wild packs of dogs, just in cattle alone. And what the people in the United States spend on dog food a year is in excess of $2 billion a year. When I visited Purina Mills, I think they said it was 150 boxcars a day of pet food goes out of there, St. Louis. And in fact, there's six times more dog pet food produced than there is baby food. And now, the latest hot thing in pet food are people crackers. They're shaped like mailmen and cops. And they have the slogan, give your dog a little somebody between meals. How'd you like that? And in addition to this, now there's another 2.5 million bucks on care for these animals, and I think that's a good thing, of course, as a veterinarian. But they blow most of the money on jewelry and perfume. The jewelry does include gold bracelets and watches. There's remarkable perfume. They eat on clothing. There's some remarkable clothing, including black lace panties, dentures, contact lenses, and there's a Happy Breath toothpaste, and now they got a new one. It's a new beef-flavored variety of toothpaste. It's really hot. And they have also, of course, there's professional pet watchers, and they have headstones, and I'll show you some pictures of some cemeteries. The most famous cemetery is down in your country, Bob, and Calabasas. Yeah, I pronounce it. It's a remarkable cemetery. I'll show you. I think I got a picture of it. And it's not only for dogs and cats, because I know of at least one goldfish buried there, as well as a pet quail. And so you have this kind of a thing going on. You can buy a jog dog machine, so you don't have to run, you know, take your dog out for runs. You can keep it in shape by getting a jog dog machine for $575. You can get false eyelashes for poodles, and you can get all his birthday kind of announcements and stuff for birthday parties, special diets. There's some fantastic diets you can get now. Really remarkable. And you can get suede tents for cats. There's pet motels and inns for dogs and cats with Snoopy linen and AstroTurf and three daily cookies between meals, three times a day. Some really great things are happening. The vice president of the Americana Hotel has a dachshund. His name is Clancy. And he has filet of chicken topped with some very exotic liquors. And before retiring each night, in his king-size bed, he often goes to the local bar, dressed in one of his 16 sweaters, and and they're all trained at this local bar, so they always give him vodka and cream de mint. He has several of them, and it's in a bowl, and he slurps it out of the bowl. Quaker State Motor Oil fortune heiress gave $14 million to take care of her her dog, and that's a pile of cabbage, along with a 180-acre farm to do it on. Now, I'll admit, when you're a veteran of medicine, you got to try to find money to take care of things, and I'm out trying to get the money. For our college, I fell into something not long ago down in Arizona, only I didn't have much to do with it except in settlement of the estate. I got this will, we now then get a will, and we got this one. I was very happy about it from the Adler estate. But as I read through it, it didn't sound too good to me because he'd given away too much money before he got to us. Because we got 60% of the remnant was to go to Washington State University for research in animals, which I would control, and that sounded rather appealing to me, and 40% for Princeton, which was his alma mater. But in this was $20,000 to take care of his pets in a manner that they'd become accustomed. Well, that was kind of interesting, and they weren't settling the state, and that's sort of where I got into it. And the attorney called us up, and he says, "We're having trouble. We can't settle his last parts until we settle out taking care of these pets." And I says, "Well, how many you got left?" "Well, one of the dogs has died, and we just got Penguin left, and Whitey, and it was a neat name. Here I've forgotten it. Don't tell the estate, the executive of the state. I'll have it memorized by the last of the month because he's coming. The real neat cat, two neat cats. Whitey is white, the other one is gray. And so I told him, "Well, we're in the business of taking care of pets, so ship them up. We'll take care of them." And we wrote a contract, and I told him it cost you, because we get 60% of the $20,000 anyway, but I charged him $3,600 to take care of these animals for the rest of the life, which was a bargain, really. And Penguin, in part of the agreement on settling the estate on Penguin, Penguin requires a ride in a car 3 times a week. That's part of the settlement estate. We're happy to do that because I haven't told you what the estate is worth. It's close to $500,000. So we're happy for those kind of things. I'm sorry I didn't get to this Quaker State Motor Oil heiress before somebody else did. I think Auburn, didn't they get some of that? $9 million or something. Well, so much for estates. Another difficulty with these dogs and cats, and one that's so kind of overwhelming, is that they're multiplying. There's about 3,000 dogs born every hour. This compares with 415 people. So you can see where we're heading. We're going to the dogs. Dogs, they're about 15 times more fertile, and cats are about 45 times more fertile than humans. And over a 7-year period, one intact female could have 4,400 progeny. And of course, this results in overpopulation. It causes one to wear buttons, like every pet a wanted pet, spay and neuter. I collect buttons. That's right. Here I have some here that veterinarians wear. What does that say?
Vote no for dog catcher.
Yeah, vote no for dog catcher and beagle power. Support your local chicken. Well, this is how we do it. But some of this is costing you money already, because some of the burden of this falls upon each city and township. There are about $100 million spent each year to put to sleep about 13 million dogs and cats. And they figure about $7 per. So, and they're usually broke, so they go to you for money or for the city council. And of course, therein lies a story that I'm going to tell you about. But before I go any further, I think Bob ought to, if you can raise your voice enough decibels so they can hear you, about some of the crazy things that happen to you. I'll just start off with one. The way some people handle their pets. When they come into a clinic, it's really great on some of them. And some of them, I mean, they're really broken up, and I can understand it. You become very attached to these beasts. And we have Charlie, and when Charlie dies, I'm sure there will be tears shed in our house. But I remember one day, this veterinary friend of mine, they brought this cat in, and they said, this cat, he described the symptomatology. And the veterinarian looked over and he says, well, it's going to have to stay here for a few days. And he says, well, I was afraid of that. So they went out and they brought in a potty chair. And they'd actually taught this cat to sit on a potty chair and play with those beads, you know. I mean, those beads. And that was pretty great. You know, now it's your turn.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you can hear me.
Yeah, they can.
But my partner treated this, and it was an alligator. It was about a 5-foot alligator. It came in for a nail trim. and it was one of the best patients he ever treated, really. This lady got the alligator when he could get him as pets. Took that long, and she kept it for 17 years, and it's become this size. It's been around the world with her twice. Her husband had passed away. She'd have to go to bed with the alligator in bed, and it'd have to have her lips against the alligator's lips until it went to sleep, and then she'd lift it out and put it in its little bed. But that's hard to believe. But you have to take my word for it. But these things do happen, because ours is a mixed practice, and we see the not so many anymore, but we treat exotics, and that could be anything from monkeys to ocelots, margays. We treated camels, llamas, you name it.
Boy, some of the crazy pets they have. They really send you. And I don't know how you feel about it. At the National Academy, where I served on a committee on the Institute of Laboratory Animal Resources, there's a committee of people working in the field that look at all the problems associated with these, and we're working on the conservation end of things, because so many of these animals, they go out and capture, a lot of course, they capture the little one, and they destroy the parents probably to get the little one, or if they capture the parents, the little ones die. I mean, it's really a tragic story on much of this. And as a result of it, in many areas, they've depleted the ranks. But then they take them to this country, and all these various cats and stuff, and they're terrible pets. Let's see, I think on Monday morning, I'll give you my story on my life in the monkey house, which I'll get into the non-human primate, which is kind of an interesting story. So I won't go into that, except to say that, I mean, we believe in pets, but pets that have been domesticated for a long time. All these exotic pets, as far as I'm concerned, are a no-no. For your sake and theirs. And one of the reasons, there are many reasons for this, and I won't go into them all, but veterinarians do a lot of things. They're responsible for the health and well-being of all these animals, now extended to sea, to aquatic and marine forms, and zoo animals, laboratory animals, but we're also involved in, and you hear the kind of practice he's in, we're in government regulation things, and also in research areas. But we're also in public health areas, and in this regard, you have to realize that there are probably about 200 diseases and disease entities that are shared in the animal kingdom and with people. And of these, many of them, are, of course, transmissible between species, and some of them have a commonality. Maybe the organism doesn't cross species lines, but some of them do. But of all these diseases, there are only 40. Which are transferred between people and people. So some of them are obtained from these other animals. So there's another very good reason for this. And I could go into quite a story of this, but we don't have time. Do you want to say any more at this stage?
I don't think so.
Now, of course, I spent much of my time in research, but I mentioned that a lot of this is costing you money as far as these excess pets go. There's a lot of cities today, for example, and we had a problem in Spokane. Some of you are from Spokane, some from Lewis and Idaho. Of course, to teach veterinarians and also to do research, You have to have animals. You have to teach students with animals. I'm not about to send out or have sent out a physician or a veterinarian who has never handled an animal. You can't learn it by looking at pictures. I don't think you want anybody operating on you if they haven't already had some practice. At least I wouldn't recommend it. And I wouldn't want you to have anesthesia that has never been tried on any animal before it tried on you. In fact, I wouldn't want one tried on your very valuable animal until it had been experimented on. You can't go to a shelf and pick off and say, hey, that looks like a good chemical. It ought to be good for anesthesia. It's ridiculous, of course, but this is what some people are asking us to do. And they say you take those animals down to the veterinary school and the students are mistreat them. And that's a horrible thing for our veterinary students to hear, because here are students that are committed to relieving suffering in animals. And so you hear some very ridiculous claims. And we pay them for the animals, and then we take very good care of them, and we put them to sleep. Instead, they put them to sleep there and charge you for it instead of having us pay for them. And much of the development in research, of course, has to be done in animals for the benefit of other animals as well as for you as people. And I'll just give you a couple of examples of this. One comes to mind very vividly because most of you have been exposed to polio victims. Many of my friends are. Some have died with polio. Yet to most of you who are very young, polio is no threat, and your parents are sleeping well tonight. They're not worried about having you become paralyzed or die with polio. And why don't they worry? The reason is that they don't worry because you've had a sugar lump or something, or a series of three or something. I don't know what the regimen is now. That vaccinates you against polio. So your chances of getting it are very slight. Now, there was a time when there was untold suffering as a result of this and much fear. But because they used some animals in some research and took a lot of monkey kidneys to develop the tissue culture to develop the vaccine against polio. And as a result of that, today, U.S. taxpayers are saved $2 billion every year. Not counting all the miserable suffering and anxiety. Now, I could go through a lot of other experiments, and just the development of the treatment of tuberculosis, for example. As a veterinarian, in fact, at Mayo Clinic, who in his research came up with which led to some of the treatment in polio. In tuberculosis, and that's no longer the threat it once was. When I was growing up, there were sanatoriums all around Western Washington. I remember many of my friends would always spend some time in the sand, short for sanatorium. And we don't have them anymore because somebody went to work on it. And this takes animals. And we try to treat them well. So that's part of the good news. That they are not only for our benefit, for our psychological well-being, which is another subject that I'm going to discuss today, but the results of the research, which I'll probably discuss with you before I leave, I usually do, so I won't say much more about that except vote no for dog catcher and vote yes for allowing your animals to be humanely treated in our institutions, in the schools of medicine and veterinary medicine and other reputable organizations. I shouldn't miss in this discussion with you to mention just a few of the heroics of dogs. There are many, of course, many stories in which animals have been a great heroes. One that I recall just within the last few years was a miniature poodle named Mimi. It was in Connecticut. And during a fire in an apartment house at night, she ran around and woke up, I think it was 8 people, licking them in their face and all, and got them aroused before the building was consumed. So they have a remarkable sense about them. Thurber recalled about his poodle, "She could take part in your gaiety and in your sorrow. She trembled to your uncertainties and lifted her head at your assurances." And they certainly do reflect us in a way, and I'm sure you can tell some of your clients by the patients, because they do sort of do reflect it. And but they are remarkable in therapy. In fact, I maintain that the people and animals through the centuries were really raised together. And to the extent that we have been parted from animal contact is to the extent that we are poorer for it, and I think more disturbed. That's ruling out some of the lunatic fringe out here that I talked a bit about earlier in this session. But pets are I think, a necessity for in many situations. I feel, for example, among the aged, in fact, I guess there are some studies to substantiate this, and it's something we're working on in Pullman in the Aging Council. If you have a good pet with an old person, chances are they will maintain their independence and maintain their home much longer, maybe up to 5 years longer than if they didn't have it, as a responsibility and also as a companion. And one of the worst things we do to old people, we haul them off into sterile retirement homes. And for some of them who've had a pet for 60 years, we say, no pet at the retirement home. And so you take away from them, at that point in life, the only thing that gives them unconditional love. And so you kill them. And kill one, you kill them both. And I think this is a terrible thing, and I'm trying to do my part in trying to relieve that situation. And today, of course, they're necessary in many areas just for protection. And you know yourself, when you're alone and the wind howls and you hear all kinds of noises, it's sure a lot different if you've got a dog here. And sometimes the bigger the better, even if they're no smarter than Bernie. And for a long time, I maintain that, and I serve on the Institute of Human Ecology, Lutheran Institute of Human Ecology, and we have a couple of hospitals. And I keep telling them every now and then, we should have facilities in the hospital, especially in the pediatric ward, where at least behind, I'd like to have them so the children could touch them, because it's very important that children have warm fuzzies that I spoke of the other day, but warm fuzzy in the nature of a pet so they can touch him. But if you're kind of sterile-minded in hospitals, then you could have them behind the glass. But if you could have pups and kittens always maintained there, I think that the time of therapy, the healing time, would be greatly shortened. In some areas, they have actually tried this out in some places, and maybe the Batons might wish to address this. I know I'm familiar with it, with a couple of situations where this has been tried. I've tried it in my own situation in our home. You bring them a pet when they're real sick and they get well pretty fast. So it does work. It has therapeutic effect on them. And I know when I was at the University of California, among other things, I was chief beagle for over 1,000 beagles. And we had one of our kennels right on the campus. And Dee is familiar with these because she saw some of them. But we then moved the main colony off the campus. But I said that you must maintain what we did here. And we always maintained a pen of pups right at the front to the students. And everybody at University of California goes by bike. And you'd see up to 50 students or more outside this pen of pups. telling their troubles to these pups. It's a lot cheaper than a psychiatrist, and sometimes even more helpful. I don't want to beat any psychiatrist out of a fee, but we veterinarians must survive too. But it's really great. Great therapeutic agents. And respecting this remarkable attachment that one sees between a person and an animal, it's most remarkable in those people who have to depend on them, such as those people with a seeing eye dog. Of course, there's great dependence observed there. And many of us for some time have promoted the use of animals in therapy for especially now some areas that I've already mentioned about poor retarded children. And many of us for some time have promoted the use of animals in therapy for especially now some areas that I've already mentioned about for retarded children. And our family and our daughter who will be coming in here next week, who is a special ed person and works with retarded children, I've been trying to encourage her in this, but she can't do it in the situation where she was in. But when we were in Norway in about 4 years ago, I made special note of this because I have a friend who's been concerned with this in Norway. That is the working with the retarded people or disabled people or people with disabilities. And there's a fellow in Norway named Erling Stordal. He's blind. And he started a thing called, I think, Bedestolen. Up on the Valdres, north and I guess about a little west of Oslo, up above Jøvik. And it's up in a ski area. And we went there and visited this place, and they have disabled people of all kinds. And one of their means of therapy is not only physiotherapy and a lot of other things, and swimming, but they also have dogs and horses there that are a very important part of the therapy. And I've recently heard that now Erling Stordal has been in this country, down at, I think, Colorado Springs, where he plans to establish a similar situation there. And I certainly hope that he does. And that was indeed an interesting day we had there, and of course especially for our younger daughter. Recently, psychologists and psychotherapists have become interested in this area of activity. And some of you, I think the other day you had a movie here, John Rinder. Is he here?
Yeah.
Okay, he might want to comment on this. I'll say a few things. I asked that I couldn't find you at dinner tonight, but I left word that I'd hoped you'd come. And he probably knows Corson, and Corson and his wife at OSU. They were in a situation where in this hospital they had some patients with disturbed children. And right below this floor where the disturbed children were, there were some dogs on some studies. Really, it was, I think, testing the effects of stress on the physiology of these dogs. And one of these disturbed children heard these dogs barking. And he asked if he might not go and visit them. And so this was arranged. And then Dr. Corson got the idea that he'd utilize these dogs in therapy for these children. And
And he found out that in fact that it worked, and he used them with the schizophrenics and with some of the withdrawn patients. And he picked out some wire-haired terriers and border collies, beagles, and cocker spaniels. And you sort of he sort of tried to match the dog with the person. Terriers are especially good for some of this because they are what we call I can't think of
hyperactive.
Well, they're hyperactive, but they're aggressive lovers. Yeah, they're like some people I know. They're aggressive lovers, and so there was a lad there that was only he was 19 years old. He was bedridden. And ever since he'd been in this hospital, he didn't communicate with anybody. He just laid in bed. And so on a long shot, they took old Arwin, who was a terrier, up there to him. And as fortune will have it, old Arwin went running right up to Stephen's bed, jumped on his bed, and started licking his face. And it was the first reaction they'd ever seen out of a Stephen. And when he finished licking his face, he jumped down, and wouldn't you know, old Stephen got up and followed him and asked where he could keep him. And after a period of therapy, which wasn't too long, he agreed to some therapy, and I think it was within less than a few months, he was discharged after he went through further therapy. So it really did work. And the beauty of them, of course, they're non-demanding. They're non-critical friends. They don't say, tell you why, or ask you why you're so crazy. I've known a few dogs I've had that were pretty sure I was, but they really never posed the question. Because they accept you and me as we are. And that's sometimes very good. And they found within these patients at this hospital that many of them, when they began bathing and taking care of these animals and having charge of them, that they began also taking better care of themselves. They were more attentive to their own personal hygiene. And these dogs gave them a link to people. And they are what we call a loving link between them and other people. And the terriers are so remarkable because they don't wait for you to make the first move. One patient was drawn to an unappealing dog. It was a big loser. I mean, you just look at the dog and you probably couldn't tell which end was which. Some of them come that way. They're some really remarkable creatures, and this one was lovable to no one. But this particular person was attracted to it. I guess they sort of needed each other. And this patient felt that the dog needed him. And as a result of it, a beautiful friendship developed, and there was much therapy that occurred. So that's sort of the gist of it. Do you want to say something, John? About rabbits or something?
Just that your comment about a loving link is a very good one. Hospital that was shown in the film, pets were used with profoundly retarded children who weren't really communicating except in very, very primitive ways. Some of them couldn't even communicate at all. And the animals were there as a loving link and enriched the whole environment. Very good thing to do.
Yeah, when I get to be dictator, I'm going to have every kid will have a kid, a little goat. Like I just came from Alaska, and I'm trying to sell Alaska on goats because I think they're great. They'll teach you. Well, we can take care of the smell with cryotherapy. Yeah, with cryotherapy, we can get rid of the scent glands, so they don't smell like a goat. We can also get some of this perfume, you know. But here's something that they're very low energy input on these, you know, because they can browse on about anything, and this is great for Alaska. They got a lot of browse up there. You can milk them, You could eat them. I know I had a pet goat, and it was really great. Trained it to harness, pulled the cart, taught me how to play King of the Mountain. You've never seen, that's where we learned King of the Mountain, you know. People didn't invent King of the Mountain. The goats did. In fact, I had a bunch of miniature goats. I got them from Thousand Oaks, the home of the...
Yeah, they stole them in.
Yeah. It cost me $1,500 for three of them. And along with Nelson, he was the stinky male goat, and we ended up with a whole yard full of them at General Electric Company. I don't know if they knew it, but they had a lot of goats for a while when I was with them. But these little goats, I'd put out a barrel out there, and these little goats are miniature goats when they're really agile, when they're only about this big, and they'd take a big leap up on this barrel, and they'd try to roll the barrel, and then the other ones would jump up on it, and they'd push them off. Or we had an irrigation pipe, and those things would run along, just like kids do, you know. They'll run along a pipe to see how far they can run. Well, the goats did that first. So we can learn a great deal from animals. And with goats, you can milk them, and then when you get through with them, you can eat them. I remember, and I ate them. You know, it was a sort of fact of life on the farm after you'd got to be an old goat, and then you made made jerky out of them. You enjoyed them even at death, you see. So that's really great. So I'm pushing goats, and in fact, at the American Veterinary Medical Association convention at Anaheim, we followed Missouri Synod at Disneyland this year in convention. And we had more success in togetherness. We had a lot of audiovisual things there. A whole big room of them, you know? And I was watching this on about any subject you can name. And the place that was always the busiest was the one on goats.
But it's not a good,
I know,
good source for
it. It's not a good source. People even call me up, think I'm a goat expert, because I published something about goats one time. I wish I had time to write a book about goats, because they're so great. And they don't get sick too much either. That's a mixed blessing for a veterinarian. the final thing before my summary, do you want to say something more about where we are on this?
No, I don't know if you go into the bit as far as, I'm thinking of the people who, you know, we get the question, when you put your dog to sleep in this bit. I don't know if you want.
Well, I think we ought to throw it. That's a good idea. We'll throw it open for questions before I give you a couple more words, and then we'll run through just a few pictures just for kicks.
Yeah. You know, people will, they'll think of this, but they don't want to convey it to the veterinarian. And you kind of have to read their mind or know what they're thinking. And on our bit, I leave it up to the people to decide, but yet they usually want, a lot of times, some people want you to decide. And this is it's a very traumatic experience for these people. And I find sometimes people have a dog, they don't want to decide then, you'll admit it, you'll do a workup on it, you'll spend the money, and then they'll decide the next day. You know, but they figure that they spent the money, they've done what they think they can do for it, and then they let you go that bit. So it's that's a very deep psychological factor when you're in a couple.
Yeah, it really is. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to decide, because is this animal that has served me for so long, is it any fun for it anymore? Is it enjoying life, or is it just tedious? Maybe it's deaf, and it can't see very well, and it isn't eating very well, and you can see that it's in pain. Yet you'd still like to have it around. But you have to ask yourself, I think, is it really fair to the animal? Is it just selfishness on your part? And I think that's an issue you, of course, have to face. And they have an advantage because most of them have then a choice of a better death than any of you or I.
I have a question for Bob. Some dogs I've known have arthritis, and it looks like it might be painful for them when they try to walk. Is it indeed painful for Is it just a stiffness?
Well, I think dogs, certain dogs have different pain thresholds. And I don't know what, this is the thing that's hard. I see many shepherds, they have a lot of hip dysplasia problem, or any of them. And you get the old shepherd that's coming in there, and what are you going to do? You know, you're going to put the dog to sleep, and, you know, you can keep it going with cortisone and butazolidine and aspirin and everything else, and then eventually, you know, you have to make the decision. And this will vary with the people that have the pet. You know, some people, they come in and they sign the slip and that's it. And other people, you know, they'll keep going on and keep hanging on to the dog. It just dribbles urine out and is a mess. And you wish they'd decide, but yet you can't. And you can hint it around to them and everything else, but they have to decide. And it's kind of tough. It's a decision to make. As to whether you're causing pain, I think this varies with the dog, you know.
Sometimes you can see if it's on one side, if they're favoring one side, chances are it's, you know, sort of hurting. Any other questions?
I have a comment, not really a question. I work in a therapeutic community for rehabilitation of drug abusers and alcoholics. And most of our people are pretty young, 17 to 25. And we're situated in a halfway house, and according to health laws, there can't be animals in a halfway house. So periodically, they come through and clean out all our pets and get rid of them. And they've taken them, my people have taken them to capturing wild animals off on safaris of different kinds, little rabbits and little ground squirrels and things like that, and keeping them hidden in their room.
Yeah.
And they've had snakes and fish and things like that, especially the warm, fuzzy animals, that's what they like. And they can't even really pet these animals because they are wild. But just having an animal and having somebody hidden under the bed is a part of a whole responsibility thing. So I'm very glad to hear that there's actually been work done with this.
Yeah, this is absolutely wrong. Boy, if there's any place you need it, you know, a good old shepherd dog or something that's there. And some of these laws they have, as far as I'm concerned, are crazy. And when we finally become civilized, we'll have some around. I know when we take we take old Charlie to the convalescent home periodically. You're really not supposed to take dogs in there, but mainly they figure, well, it's a tripping hazard. But now and then we carry Charlie in, and some of those patients just like lodestone. They're just like attracted to it. You know, they want to pet old Charlie. Well, everybody wants to pet Charlie, and I don't blame them, because Charlie's a lovable old dog. But they're just hungry for this. It's a tragedy.
Why aren't animals allowed in halfway houses?
Health ordinances, probably.
The health code is what the people who run it. But I have a feeling that the people who run it, and this is my own, I think that they don't like us to be happy. And that's, you know, kind of the cycle that's gotten there. It seems like they'll let, for instance, the little stray dogs and cats come up, and our people start taking care of them, set out food. Well, that's food that gets taken off the table, a little scrap of fish or something like that, and they rap about that. But it seems like they let it wait 2 or 3 weeks, and then they say, now the health code says that we got to get rid of these animals, and they take them off, or after our people have already become attached to them. And it's kind of a thing where to protect our own clients, we tell them when the animals first show up, we can't keep pets. And then they find something and hide it under the bed, and we don't say anything about it, because we know that one's going to get away with keeping that ground squirrel for weeks.
What I have proposed in our situation on this is that, I don't know quite how we'll resolve it. At the university, a lot of students come and they have to leave their pets at home. We face this issue there. Some of them bring their pets, but they don't treat them very well. And so we have to do something about that, too. And what I'd like to do is have areas where they can rent facilities or have the dormitory or fraternity dog and cat as a well-behaved and well-trained pet, so that you do have then access to companion animals. And I'd like to have a pen outside the stable of the home where you have a pen just outside the home, so they can go there to the animals and pet them. So maybe you can get out from having them inside. And I think this is a compromise that I'm looking at now. And another thing we're doing, because so many people don't know how to care for animals, but worse than that, they don't know the responsibility of pet care. And this is a very serious thing. And what I did in coming back to Washington State University, I was trying to get our faculty to have a course for the veterinarians to know how to do it, but the rest of the people, so many of them, the students are just, they love them and leave them. They get the dog or the cat and they have them, and then on June 9th when they leave town, they leave town and leave the dog or the cat back there. And this is a very terrible thing. And it really tears me up, and it tears a lot of people up, and it also tears up the community. And this happens all over. They might drop them off just somewhere and say, well, they hope some farmer gets it. Well, this is a very terrible thing. So what we've done, and my faculty is enough to do anyway, so what we did this last year, I got the students, and we have some remarkable students in veterinary medicine these days, and I got them all psyched up on it, and they line up a course and presented it on pet care and pet responsibility. And they did it at night for the community. In fact, there were some faculty there from across the road, and there were students and from people from the town. And they did a remarkable job of this, and of course the beauty of this is that the students were learning more than the people there, because nobody learns more than the people who has to teach the course. So there was method in my madness. And they really did a remarkable job, and now we're going to, this next year, we hope to repeat it, but also maybe have a short course on it for youngsters, fifth grade or above, at the clinic, maybe on Saturdays, to teach them then responsibility, but some of the rudiments of care and training of these animals. Because you know so many of them, they don't know tiddly-dee about it, do they? They know the front end from the back end, they know the north end from the south end, but that's about all. And on some animals, it's English sheepdogs, you're not real sure. But are there any other questions?
I wonder if people have a hang-up wondering whether these pets, say rabbits or cats or dogs, could be examined and given a clean bill of health so that they wouldn't have a disease that could be passed on to the patients of an institution. Is it rather easy or difficult to examine, say, a pet rabbit to find out whether he's got something that could be given to a child in an institution where they might be used?
The physicians here could probably do a better job than I. And you wish to address it. I'll start off while you're thinking about it. There are a number of serological tests we can do that are quite extensive on a whole variety of microorganisms, viruses and such. With rabbits, they aren't too bad, really. Of course, with a wild rabbit, you have the danger of tularemia and some of these, but you've got to have a vector involved here. And as long as you don't have a lot of vectors on your pet rabbits, and most of them don't. And when I was a kid, I raised pet rabbits all the time, a whole bunch of us did, and the rabbits sort of came out second best. We never caught anything from the rabbits. The rabbits were the ones in jeopardy. So rabbits aren't too bad an animal from this standpoint. With goats, you got the problem, the main problem there, and it's very easy, tuberculosis and undulant fever are two of the ones you worry most about. With dogs and cats, some of them are worried about toxoplasmosis in the cats with pregnant women, but that isn't as big a hazard as they thought.
Ringworm,
yeah, cats and ringworm, that's a common entity, that's certainly diagnosed, but I think the cat is, sometimes I think catch it from the kids. But
we're seeing more rabbits as pets than we have before. And the people are willing to spend the money, you know, for it, and some of them make pretty good pittance, evidently. I mean, as far as training them, so forth.
We had some friends that had a house built in Randolph. I
hadn't seen it, but when Randolph wanted to go with the door on it. Yeah. You're seeing more of this. We're seeing more in our practice, more rabbits. We feed a fair number of goats. We're seeing more and more goats all along.
Yeah.
And, or you name it, but we're seeing more of them.
Yeah. And more and more birds, too, especially in the big cities. Because we have an excrement problem with dogs in some cities. They'll soon have an ordinance where you have to sort of clean up the mess. Carry a vacuum cleaner and a pan with you when you go out for with your dog. Maybe a jar, too, I don't know. But I'll have to invent a better fire plug. Any other questions? One observation I made on dogs, I think I've told you some of it before. These are mainly for you parents. If you see a mother dog with pups, and if you count the number of times that mother dog licks and gentles the pups versus the number of times that she growls or bites at them, you'll find it's a ratio of about 9-1 on the gentling versus the growling and the biting. Now, I'm not as good an observer on people as I am on dogs, but my limited observations on people is that the reverse is true, that there's about 9 bites and growls to every 1 gentling. And I think the mother dogs are doing a better job. All right? Now, we'll have just a few slides to summarize what we've tried to tell you. I don't know if you can see this, but I thought you'd have some little fun with these slides. Some of you have probably seen them before. That's what we've been talking about. This is one of my favorite pictures. And we try to, what we're trying to tell you here is that we don't want to anthropomorphize, if there is such a word. We don't want to try to make people out of our pets. This happens to be a lady reading the Bible, a man reading a book on prayer, and a dog reading dogma. It reminds me of the chimpanzee who came into the local library. His name was Goliath. And he says, "Goliath, what do you want?" And he says, I want 2 things today, Darwin's Origin of the Species and the Bible. And he says, "Well, what the world do you want those two for? Why that selection?" He says, "I want to find out whether I'm my keeper's brother or my brother's keeper." what we do to our pets. Here's a guy. He looks like he's about as old as I am and weighs twice as much. And he's carrying his old dog. And he's chasing a car, and he says, 19 years old, and he still loves chasing cars. And here's some of the stuff I told you about. These poodles that are gilt-edged, and I won't tell you how much this thing cost, but plenty. And now they're going to having matched sets here of the same kind of material on the lady as on her dog. And it has bracelets too, made of gold. And I think that's a gilded bowl for this Siamese in a leather upholstered chair with her own bed. And then here are the various meals, various selections for dinner for these various ones. They've gone into some remarkable diet preparations in dogs. Fantastic. And then here's this graveyard that, I don't know if you can't see it from way back there, but you can run through them up here.
And here, right on this shot, there's three right here with tremendous flowers and everything for their pets. And this is to Penny, born 3-17-66, died 1-1-70. She never knew she was a rabbit. It's too bad, you know. You just let the rabbit be a rabbit. And then here's this exotic thing. Here's a raccoon. You know, and raccoons don't belong in people's houses. I know one of my friends had to, he got a raccoon in him, and he wanted the canines ground down because it was getting too rough for the children. And then these boa constrictors. They belong where they were born. If they were born in the jungle, that's where they belong.
Can I tell you about one in Portland? A lady had a 25-foot boa constrictor in Portland, Oregon, and just before we left home, she was giving it a bath in the bathroom, and it got out the bathroom window, and the message came over the radio not to fear because it couldn't eat children.
Just squeezes up to death.
Foot. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We're always getting these, you know, and some poisonous ones, you know, they get away or they just release them. Some joker, I think, released a bunch of rattlesnakes up on the, well, I better not tell you where. This is quite a while ago. And then I mentioned the greatness of these animals in research. This happens to be our older daughter that drew this for me. Here's a dog that's salivating at the sight of food, and he's dripping out of a hole in his stomach as this fellow rings a bell. That happens to be Pavlov when he worked out, you know, conditional response, and he got the Nobel Prize for it. I won't tell you about the rest of it. And here is here's a little black child with a pet rabbit to remind you then of their great value in therapy. We also tried to summarize some of that for you. And the remarkable effect this has therapeutically. And here's another retarded child with her dog. And we mentioned some of the remarkable things that have occurred in that area. And that we should show respect for all animals, reverence for all of life, as certainly Schweitzer, in more than anyone in this century, brought to our attention. But that we have respect and reverence for them, but to also understand them and not to do the terrible things that we do to them, either on the mistreatment or maltreatment that we accord them. And this is all we have to say tonight. Unless you have some special questions for us, and I'm most appreciative that Bob stood by me here.